Hi, I'm Kim Polishuk.
And I'm Jen Giffen from
Shooks and Giff, the podcast. A part of the Education Podcast Network.
Just like the show you're listening to right now.
Shows on the network are individually owned and opinions expressed may not reflect others.
Find other interesting education podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com.
But I really think that if parents, administrators, policymakers, just the general public really knew what it was like to teach, warts and all, not this like idealized version, that we'd be better off.
Welcome to the Leader of Learning podcast. This is where educators can come to find inspiration to transform education through effective leadership. I'm your host, Dr. Dan Krynas, and my research and leadership experiences have led me to understand that someone like you, regardless of your role or your title, can truly make an impact in your organization. I chat with amazing guests who epitomize what it truly means to be a leader of learning. I'm so glad you've tuned in. Let's get started. Hey there, Leader of Learning. Welcome to episode 114. I can't believe it. This school year, in my opinion, has gone pretty quickly, and we're getting toward the end of it. And one of the things that I think has come a long way and has had lots of ups and downs this school year is the reputation of schools and specifically educators. My guest in this episode, Aaron Pribble, is the author of a couple of books, one of those being Teacherland: Inside the Myth of the American Educator. So I was really excited to talk to him about some of these myths that people have when they think of teachers and educators in general. Aaron also authors the book Writing in the Social Studies, and we talk about that as well. But I know you're going to get a lot of value out of this episode, especially when we talk about those myths. So stay tuned. Coming up is my interview with Aaron Pribble. It is my honor to be speaking in this episode to Aaron Pribble, who is a teacher and an author and has written multiple books now about everything from the hidden myths of education to teaching social studies. And I'm really excited to talk to Aaron. So Aaron, welcome to the show. And if you could just introduce yourself to everybody, who you are, where you are, what you do.
For sure. Yeah. Thanks so much. Thanks for the introduction. My name is Aaron Pribble, and I teach high school social studies just across the Golden Gate Bridge, just north of San Francisco. I've been teaching for a while now, so I kind of wear all sorts of hats in education, coaches, teaching a variety of subjects, and it's been great. And then, you know, when I can, I really enjoy writing as well.
Yeah. So listen, you said that you have worn many hats in education, including as a classroom teacher, and you also said, you know, coaching. What are some things that you've really enjoyed, I guess, throughout the years in terms of those different hats, and which ones have you liked the most? Which ones maybe didn't you like the best?
Yeah. Well, I'll save you what I didn't like the best, maybe for a little later. And this gets into some of the things I think we're going to talk about. But coaching was great. I was a baseball player in a former life and college and for a few years after that and stuff. Actually, that's how I got into writing. My first book was a memoir about playing in the first and only season of professional baseball in Israel, which was kind of like Bull Durham and Tel Aviv. It was just an insane experience. And it was great. I had been stopped playing baseball for like 3 years and I was teaching. I was at the same high school that I'm at now for three. I've been quote unquote retired for 3 years. And I heard about this league and I was like, let's see if I can dust off the wing and see what I got. So I went back and I played. And at the end of the summer, it was such an amazing experience that I thought I just wanted to try my hand at writing. So that's been great, but it's also nice to coach baseball. I coached the baseball team, but also the basketball team. I've coached the mock trial teams. And one thing that I realized really early on, I was a rookie teacher in my first year coaching. I was an assistant coach of the varsity basketball team. And I realized that the way the head coach was teaching something of how to get open on the wing, and he was teaching the V cut, the L cut, and the seal. And I had this epiphany. I'm a young teacher. I'm trying to figure out how to teach. And I realized that teaching is a lot like coaching. The same way that you would introduce an idea, get players to practice, blow the whistle, give guided feedback, there's a lot of similarities. So I'd say one of the highlights has been coaching, because I really learned a lot about how to teach from watching various coaches coach.
You know, I share a similar experience. I probably haven't coached as long as you have, but for 3 years, I was the baseball coach at one of the middle schools that I worked at. And to be honest, although I love baseball and I played growing up, I sort of got into that role basically out of desperation, not my desperation, but the school's, because basically if no one had offered, I was going to say volunteered, but I was paid. If no one had offered to coach that team that year, there wasn't going to be a team. And of course, it was like, well, who knows how long they're not going to have a team for and whether it even comes back at that point. So I said, okay, I'll do it. And I really enjoyed it for the 3 years that I did it. I stopped really when I made the decision. Actually, I think it was really more when I dove more deeply into my doctoral work. And I said, I just don't have the time to really make that commitment anymore. But one of the things that I loved about coaching was just the opportunity, like you said, to extend teaching or to teach in a different Yep. way beyond the classroom. And we say all the time about how important it is to build relationships with other educators and, of course, with students, and just being able to have the kinds of out of the classroom relationships with the players on my teams was really, really special. And I haven't gotten too many opportunities to talk on the podcast about coaching over the years. And again, I know that that's not necessarily where the conversation was going to lead tonight either, but I think it was Mark Barnes. We talked about coaching at one point too, but it hasn't come up too much on the podcast. And I'm glad you brought that up because I really do think that it is education, it is teaching, it's relationship building, but it's so much different. And it, like, I think it has a lot more power potentially for the players, but certainly the coaches in terms of the impact that you can actually make on someone's life beyond the classroom.
Yeah, I totally agree. And if we're talking about myths in education or teaching, I think one of the big ones is teachers are just that. They're only classroom teachers. And there's so much more that goes into the job, all the extracurriculars. We need an advisor for this club. So you end up doing three of those. And then just all the other things that end up happening. So the notion that teachers really are so much more than just, you know, what you do in the classroom, even that's the bulk of your job. That's really important. I love what you said about building relationships with kids in a different way outside of the classroom too. You know, I was 24, I guess, when I first started teaching and wasn't great. But having that relationship with the varsity basketball team and Jimmy walks in, who's the best player on the team. Hey, what's up, Jimmy? And you know, and Jimmy, if Jimmy's cool with you, then the rest of the class is probably cool with you. So in some ways, it was not a crutch in a bad way, but it's just so helpful. And it showed me that, you know, from there, what are other students' hobbies, right? It's just such a great way to plug into students' lives. This girl plays basketball. This girl is into horses. This kid's into skating, whatever it is. That's just, it's just a really important part of teaching. And you know, something that a lot of people from the outside don't necessarily consider.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. As a matter of fact, it's kind of a weird coincidence. I think just earlier today, I was having a conversation with my wife in the car as we were driving, and I rehashed a memory that I had of one of the years that I coached the baseball team about a player who really nobody wanted on the team. Other than me and maybe a few of the players, but certainly the parents didn't. And I'm not even sure the administration at the school. And the reason for that was because I don't think he was officially expelled from school, but he was placed into sort of an alternate program that we had because he just wasn't thriving, especially behaviorally in the traditional classroom. And, I just knew he was a good athlete. I don't know that I really saw him play much before I had him try out for the team, but he was good enough to make the team athletically. And I was willing to kind of take a flyer on him to say, look, if you can keep up your end of the bargain in the classroom and in the program that you're in, then let's give it a shot. You know, I'll take you on the team. And again, he was a great athlete and we had some bumps in the road, but it was definitely one of those things where I wasn't at that point just a teacher or even just a coach. It was really an opportunity that I had to help him out, but that he got an opportunity to still hone his interpersonal and social skills outside of the classroom when really at that point in at least his educational career, he wasn't getting a lot of those opportunities in school.
Yeah, it's such a great anecdote. I think a lot of times on a sports team, coaches and even teammates will let the really good players have a longer leash and will get away with stuff. So that's one thing that happens. But then there's that kid oftentimes at the end of the bench, right? If you're going to be one of those end of the bench guys, you better be sterling. You better be perfect. You better be a good team guy. But as you said, to take a flyer on a kid, it's so important because sports can be the world for some students who aren't necessarily plugged in to school. And I'm sure you've had this experience and other teachers as well. A lot of times student athletes will have their best GPA in the season in which they're playing because they're focused. They got to double down. Even if they're not a great, even if they're a C student or whatever, they're dialed in because they know if they want to play football, they got to, you know, cross the T's and dot the I's and really get everything done. So in a lot of ways, sports can keep kids on track. And then it can also be like an entree into this, into social thing. This kid who maybe was an outsider, maybe had a tough time. Now he's building relationships with kids that he ordinarily wouldn't. He sees an adult. Maybe that adult becomes like a trusted figure in his life. In my own life, outside of my dad, you know, my coaches were the biggest role models in you know, in my life. So it's just so, it's a good on you, you know, for doing that. But that's so great for certain kids because that's basically all they got.
Yeah. Now going back to what we mentioned about how sometimes coaching is sort of a myth that, you know, teachers can only be teachers inside the classroom. You wrote a book, right, called Teacher Land. And essentially the book explores some hidden myths of education, at least in this country. And I think there are a lot of them. I don't know quite how many you covered in the book. I think in just the last 12 months now that we've been in this pandemic, we've certainly seen some of them come to light more through dealing with what we've had to deal with. Namely, I think when we first got into the pandemic, people were like, "Oh, teachers are real heroes. Look at them go. They're trying to do everything in their power to make education thrive and move forward, even in these trying times, and even when people have to work and learn from home." And to be honest, I think more recently it's been sort of the opposite. It's been a lot of why are teachers complaining so much about going back to work?
Right.
Why, you know, they have to earn, they should earn their paycheck just like everyone else does. And now it's sort of the, I don't know, the anti-hero like we were 12 months ago. I know your book came out well before the pandemic, but I was wondering if you might be able to weigh in on those myths and of course mention some more that you cover and that you like to talk about.
Yeah, for sure. I think the thesis of the book, not that I'm that like explicit, this sentence doesn't occur, I don't think, anywhere in Teacherland. It's that I kind of wanted to improve our education systems by humanizing the teaching profession. And I think, like you said, this is a really good case study. I think a lot of people think they knew what it's like to be in the classroom because they spent a decade, two decades on the other side of it in desk. So a lot of people infer, I know what it's like because I've had a number of teachers and this has got to be what it's like, but it's not really the case. So the pandemic did shine a bit of a light or open up an interesting window. When I've been Zooming and had students at home, sometimes you'll hear a parent chime in, like with a mom giving an answer or something to a question, which is interesting unto itself. So parents can like get to see our practice a little bit more intimately. Cameras have not been beamed directly into our classrooms. Maybe that's coming down the pike, maybe not. But I really think that if parents, administrators, policymakers, just the general public really knew what it was like to teach, warts and all, not this like idealized version, that we'd be better off, that parents would have a better experience, students would ultimately better off, and we'd have better policy too.
You know, I do agree with what you said as far as like, unfortunately, people know education from their experience in education. I don't know what the statistics are, but let's just say a vast majority or almost everyone in this country goes through some sort of formal education in their early years. I know it's not like that for everyone, and I know it's not like that certainly in other areas of the world, but in our country, it's like that. And so I think that one, and I've talked about this a number of times on this show. I think maybe my listeners know all too well. Like, I wrote a dissertation essentially on how people can cope with change and break through teacher resistance. And I think one of the reasons why there's a lot of resistance around education or myths in this case, like we're talking about, is because parents, feel like education needs to be the same way it was when they were in school. Right. And teachers get so comfortable doing things over there the first several years that they're in the classroom and they think they want to keep doing it the same way. And it just gets stuck. It's like a time warp or something.
Yeah, no, that's really true. You know, where kind of the inspiration for Teacherland, I was a big fan of Anthony Bourdain just in general and his book Kitchen Confidential. And I thought I basically wanted to do for teachers what he did for cooks, right? He wrote it, the books end up being two different things, but that was my inspiration. He gave us this unvarnished look what it was like. And it occurred to me, we go to restaurants. Everybody has been to a restaurant. You dine out, the food comes. Maybe you see the chef over there. There's the cooks on the line. And you kind of infer what that job is like from your experience outside or external to that. And so I just thought that that was very similar, whether we're sitting down at a table to eat or sitting down at a desk to receive a lesson. A lot of people assume what it's like on the other side, right? In the behind the grill or whatever, or sitting up there in front of, stand up there in front of the whiteboard. So that's kind of was the inspiration for it. And when I thought about, you know, what were some of the stereotypes about teachers, it seems to me, at least in the popular narrative, there are two big stereotypes. It's the saint and the slouch. Like you said, we were lionized, right? Thank you so much. This amazing job. We could kind of go down a list. We can make two columns of all the movies and TV shows, right? Stand and Deliver being just the classic, all the great teachers. And then there's everything on the other side of the column, right? They're lazy. You can't fire them. They're rubber roomers. Bad Teacher was literally the name of a movie that's come out in the past decade. So, you know, there's these two opposites. And I don't think I know of a single teacher who fits either one of those categories. The truth is somewhere in between at varying points along the spectrum. And if I could just try to really give more of an honest view, warts and all, the good, bad, the ugly, and otherwise, that ultimately I think would be a good thing all around.
Let me ask you a question following up on what you said about sort of the saint and the slouch. I guess let's go more toward the saint, because I've had this conversation before and I'm interested to see what you think about it. Is some of the problem, at least, or maybe most of the problem when it comes to that sainthood aspect of being an educator, does that come from us? Are educators most guilty of portraying that when they're, you know, planning lessons on weekends, working long hours, making all sorts of phone calls to families, like all the things that may or may not be above and beyond the call of duty or outside of contractual hours? What do you think?
Yeah, that's fascinating. I've never considered that before. So that's a super interesting take. I certainly have a number of teacher friends who are like that, right? I mean, people put in varying hours. Some people, right when the bell rings, they're looking and boom, they're gone. They're the first ones in the parking lot. Some people, I saw a teacher friend last weekend while I was like, hey, Steve, where are you walking from? It was a Saturday afternoon and he had his backpack on. He was just at school grading papers and he was walking home. So some people put in that time on the weekends. And especially now, this has been, for the vast majority of my colleagues, the hardest years of their career, hands down, because they've been doing so much more. And it's interesting, while that's true, I think some teachers emphasize it more than others. Some people just kind of put their head down and get to work and do the work that they need to. But then I think you're right. There are really a number of teachers who go, oh my gosh, things are so hard right now. And they're very verbal about it. But I wonder, is it the preponderance of the reason for those stereotypes or not? I'm not sure, but that's great. I'm going to chew on that a little bit more. Like how much does come from the teachers themselves? Because we like to milk it, right?
Yeah. Well, and you know, I thought about this once. I was having a conversation with a group of educators about kind of what I mentioned before in terms of the pandemic, how it seems like it's come sort of full circle, and now people are bashing educators or at least blaming people for not being as willing as they want them to be to go back in school in person, and blaming teachers for not feeling ready enough. And essentially what I was told is maybe it's kind of our fault. Right. Maybe we did almost like too good of a job during the pandemic, and now people are, I don't know, just expecting too much maybe. But I think, I guess going back to something that you were saying a little while ago, in terms of there being kind of that happy medium in between the saint and the slouch, I do think that's true for a lot of reasons. One, I think the Saint is not sustainable.
Yep.
And I also think in some ways it's not realistic. That's not to say that there aren't teachers out there doing amazing things. I'm not taking anything away from people who are really going above and beyond. I guess I just don't necessarily believe that they're doing it day in and day out. For the most part. So I appreciate that conversation. And I wonder too, where some of this comes from in terms of that Saint and slouch myth. Any other myths that you talk about that might be interesting? I think that's a great one. And I think, like you said, that it kind of all boils down to that. But what else are we working with?
Yeah, I think a lot of the other myths kind of fall out from there. But just to kind of, okay. If I could, one more thing on the Slate thing. It's not on the Saint thing. It's not that we're not like do-gooders. Or I think a lot of one of the reasons why I got into teaching is because I wanted to do something good for the world, right? There is that moral element. I felt good about working with kids, the content. I'm obviously passionate about social studies because I'm a social studies teacher. I think you can do a lot of good work there in those 4 years, but we still get a paycheck, right? So one of the elements or one of the facets of not being a saint is we're not doing it for free. We're not in a nunnery or anything like that, right? We still get a paycheck. Most of us might drive Honda Civics for our first few years of teaching, but that is part of it. And I've seen a number, my wife is in business. She went to business school, and a number of her friends and graduates now, and they're successful business people, were teachers who basically decided they would never put it this way, but they basically decided that they were a little bit more ambitious. They weren't making the salaries that they wanted to make, and they had to do something else, right? So that's just really a shame, right? Teachers need to make a living. They care. I think the vast, vast, vast majority, I venture to guess all teachers, are there because they think it's like a good thing for the world, but that's not it, right? There are other facets to it. And at the end of the day, you know, we still need to get a paycheck.
Yeah. You know, when you were talking before, it kind of made me think about the argument, if you will, about whether or not teaching is more like a career or lifestyle versus just a job. And again, I think it's, you know, probably realistically speaking, it's in the middle somewhere. It's certainly not just a job. And I've said before that I think teachers and educators in general take things so personally. And that's because they invest so much of themselves. They're so passionate about what they do. So it can't be just a job for so many, probably almost all educators. But at the same time, it's not what they, or it maybe shouldn't be what they live, breathe, sleep, eat, you know, think about 24/7. You know, they need lives and have families and things too.
Yeah, no, that's really true. Early on when I was going to school to get a teaching credential, I remember, you know, one of my professors said, if you don't have a Saturday and you don't have a Sunday, you're going to be no good on Monday, right? And obviously people still take papers home and do grading and work on the weekends. But you need to have like a little time to decompress. And they're kind of like that self-care. And I think that's a really important component. Another myth, this is a bit of a lighthearted one, but you know, they say, what are the three best parts of teaching? June, July, and August, right? Well, first of all, it's not June, July, and August. It's more like 2 months instead of three. But that is a myth. People get into it for the summer breaks and the winter breaks. And early on, I realized, and someone told this to me, if you're in it for the time off, you're not going to make it, right? The let's just say the 10 months out of the year when you are actually teaching, those are going to be too miserable to make those 2 months pay off. So it's wonderful. It's nice to have the time. And I think you can make a really good argument for why those breaks are necessary. Kind of like we were talking about sports in a season, there's an off season and there's a season and there's a purpose to both of those things. But the fact that teachers are in it just for the vacation, I don't think is true. Like I said, it's awesome, but there's much more to it. I think early on you realize, do you like being in the classroom? Do you like working with kids? And that's great. There's a difference between, you know, spending 8 hours on a Sunday in grading. And then, you know, I think a lot of teachers, especially if it's really in your bones, you could be in Greece, you could be traveling in Texas, wherever you are, something might pop up. You might read an article or see something and think, I could use that in my classroom, right? And it doesn't matter. You could be all the way across the world and you could think, I'm going to use this in class next year. So at a certain extent, you can never kind of turn it off. If you got the teaching bug, you can never quash it. And that's great. But you know, you don't want to be doing it. You don't want that to be the only thing you're doing all Saturday, all Sunday, et cetera.
Well, you're talking to a guy who has literally spent only one summer of my adult life not working at a summer camp. So, and also I should mention, I should also mention that for 4 years up until about this time last year, I was balancing, being an educator, being a father and a husband with being a doctoral student. And that wasn't easy either. So, all this to say, I would never judge anyone for whether or not they got into teaching for the money or for the summers off. But I'm just saying, you know, a lot of times it just doesn't work out like that, where it's like, oh, I'm just going to completely take the summer off, when it's like, well, we might actually need to keep working in the summertime to feed our families and earn a little bit more money on top of what we're already getting, because, well, it might not be good enough. But I appreciate all the talk about myths. I did want to ask you before we start to wrap up, though, about your most recent publication, which is Writing in the Social Studies. So Writing in the Social Studies, it intrigues me because I'm a former classroom ELA teacher. At this point in my career, I've been coaching, instructional coaching, and really gearing more toward instructional technology. But as a humanities guy and as someone who really does love writing and love teaching writing, it really intrigues me. So what is it about writing in the social studies that you're sharing out there?
Yeah, well, when I looked around, you know, I had experience, I had written a couple books, and it's something that I just kind of realized, maybe discovered not later in life, but some point, you know, after I graduated college, that this really fit me and it resonated with me. And I believe really strongly in teaching, not just writing, but skills through content, to borrow a Tony Wagner phrase. I just believe that it's really important to teach skills through content. That if you're just doing one or the other, you're missing a big opportunity, especially in social studies, especially in history, world history, US history. There's such a crush of content, right? More and more every year, that a lot of teachers feel like overwhelmed. I don't have time to do it. And so that's something that I noticed, like, that I struggle with, how to incorporate teaching skills through content in my own practice, reading skills, writing skills, speaking skills. And then when I looked around, there were a few, you know, resources here and there, but I just really didn't see a ton of, here's a guide to help teachers, social studies teachers in particular, teach writing. English, you have to teach writing, or at least you should. Maybe you're encouraged in other disciplines as well. Not sure how much writing is going on in math. But social studies is this weird lane where a lot of teachers are doing a lot of great writing instruction, but my guess is that some teachers aren't doing a lot of writing instruction in social studies. And I just really wanted to create an enjoyable, fun, but still a guide to, like, help teachers to maybe get them to consider some ideas, but also, here's an idea for tomorrow. Here's a handout that students can use tomorrow. Here are some ideas for a project, a summative unit assessment to try tomorrow. Here's some of the writing that you could do on a weekly basis. And I just, you know, I'm hoping that people out there will find that resource useful.
That's great. And I think it is really important as we get into some sort of newer school methods when it comes to getting students to create, or in this case, write about things that are happening out there in the world, and dare I say, you know, more of an authentic audience than just the classroom teacher.
Yep. I think that just, like, a mental framework for social studies teachers to think about is, what kind of writing exists in the world, and can we get our students to do that? As an example, there's the book report is, like, I don't know, never seen a high school teacher assign a book report, but the quote unquote book report, I've never read a book report in real life, but there are plenty of book reviews. A book review is a great genre, right? The New York Review of Books. There's a number of places that publish book reviews. That's a great genre. So have kids actually write a book review. And then, to take it a step further in terms of finding outside voices, submit it for publication and see if a magazine will actually publish your review, and you might even get paid for your writing. But to take it a step further, sometimes what I'll do in class is I'll say, I'm not going to grade this until you show me proof of submission. It can be to the local newspaper, like to the school newspaper. It can be to a local paper. It can be to a national publication. But that really raises the stakes, right? People, not just your teacher, but people are actually going to read your writing.
And I love that. And the reason I love that so much, especially right now, as we're, you know, we're past a year into this pandemic, and schools have looked different from how they used to look, and students are learning differently than they've ever learned before. I won't tolerate anyone saying that there's a learning gap or that students are falling behind because, and I'm guessing you're going to share the same sentiments here. I believe that right now the skills that students are learning in the pandemic and dealing with everything that they've had to deal with are probably far more important than maybe some of the content that was just being spewed at them for the past however long they've been in school. And I think some of these things that we're talking about are ways certainly that teachers can do that. And that's why I appreciate you coming on here. I appreciate what you've shared in your book and on this podcast, because I think that those type of skills, and again, probably doesn't even matter what type of task you're asking your students to work on. If you're really opening up the opportunities and experiences for them to publish to a more authentic audience and do more real world relevant work, project-based learning, you're on the right track. And that's why our students have not fallen behind. As a matter of fact, they're probably more advanced than they were this time last year.
I'm with you. You know, I can hear a lot of teachers saying, well, my content is important. As a social studies teacher, I think content is super important, but they're both, right? They're both, is one more important than the other? They're both super important. And I think what this experience, this pandemic has highlighted for all of us is just all the other things. The content is important. I like to think that social studies content indeed helps us understand the world better, become better citizens and all that. But aside from the specific content, all those other skills that enshroud it are huge, you know, growth, grit, determination, growth mindset, persistence, to say nothing of mental health and all the stuff there. But you know, what's more important than having a good mindset, having a growth mindset, having a positive outlook, being persistent? If we can throw everything else out, if we can get students just to do those things, I think it's a win.
Absolutely. And I want to end on that note, because that was very, very well said. And I think it is really the culminating point in this conversation and a nice kind of period to the podcast episode. Aaron, I really appreciate your time. I appreciate your work. Please share how the listeners can find your work and find you in case they want to follow up with any more information or any questions.
Perfect. I'm a big supporter of local bookstores. So visit your local bookstore and check out Teacherland or Writing in the Social Studies or Pitching in the Promised Land for that matter. All those books are available on the World Wide Web. And, you know, I'm at Aaron Pribble on Twitter. Those are probably the best places to go. And thanks so much for having me on. This was a great time, and I really do enjoy this podcast.
Well, that'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't done so yet, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast app. Also, if you enjoy the content shared on the show, please recommend this podcast to other educators, leaders, friends, or anyone you think would love listening and learning. I would also appreciate it if you would leave a positive rating and review on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, or whatever podcast app you use to listen. For more information about me or this show, head over to leaderoflearning.com. While you're there, you can also find the Leader of Learning blog, how to connect on social media such as Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Voxer, sign up for our newsletter, and even find out how to purchase Leader of Learning merchandise. Thanks again, and remember, no matter who you are or where you are, you too can be a leader of learning.